This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is America out to defeat Russia? Why? Is Russia that rich? Is America that broke? Why did Russia help Donald Trump get elected, if they did? Who is pushing stories of nuclear war and profiting from public fear? I've got so many questions, and I have my suspicions, but it is hard to know. Looking for answers, or at least some clues, I phoned Greg Mello for a conversation. He trained as an engineer and planner. In 1989, Greg co-founded a nonprofit called Los Alamos Study Group. He's still the executive director. Greg researches and writes about global security. His articles have appeared in The Washington Post, The New York Times, and more. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Greg Mello, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Great to be here.
We live in astounding times, with the President of the United States engaging in some very risky behavior, and he's got the nuclear launch codes. Greg, what could go wrong?
Oh, a lot of things could go wrong. I guess I may be in a minority, but I don't think that he's very much more dangerous than the more rational, coldly calculating people who think that they can control the world. And then that type of person can easily back themselves into a, and the country and the world, into a corner.
Well, I sort of know what you're talking about. There was the whole direction that several presidents have taken that America should control everything. But there was at least sort of a series of procedures and understandings that you would think would precede any decision to launch nuclear weapons. But now it looks like it could be done even on an impulse if he's got that much power.
Yes, we had a discussion about that, and some of us around here the other day, and we're not sure that the public narrative about that is 1,000% accurate. And it would have to be stated that he had the complete power to launch a nuclear strike on moment's notice, but it might actually be a little different. Someone who worked in the Pentagon under Nixon, toward the end, there was someone staying in the Secretary of Defense's office, or else it was the operations room of the Pentagon, to intercept a potential call from Nixon about a nuclear strike to make sure it didn't happen.
Well, that would be a comforting thought, I think. All right, but look, Greg, the mother of all bombs was tested in Afghanistan, complete with an official government video so we could all admire the gigantic explosion. And it seems like a small step from there to venture a tactical nuclear weapon on North Korea or even a complete attempt at debilitating them with the first strike. Would you be surprised if that happened?
Oh, I'd be very surprised. It has been discussed before, and is, you know, discussed from time to time. I recall the first time being in Senator Domenici's office in Washington. His staff member had just returned from the Pentagon, where they had gotten a briefing on nuking North Korea. Believe it or not, Wagner's Götterdämmerung was playing in the background, and the man, the gentleman, the staff member, whose name I don't need to mention, asked me what I thought. You could see him, the wheels turning. He said, I've got an actual peace activist here in my office. Maybe I'll ask him, see what response I can get about nuking North Korea. So he did ask me. He asked me what I thought about that. So, you know, it's always in the background. Scenarios are worked out. But the analysis of Lee Butler from many years ago still stands, that if the United States should use a nuclear weapon, it would immediately martyr the enemy, empower terrorists and other would-be enemies, unleash a race for proliferation. And I think that pretty much all those things are well understood around the federal government.
Well, now, when it comes to Russia, I'm not a fan of Russian autocracy, and I'm wary of Russian organized crime, but I can't help notice that American actions to threaten Russia are ongoing by putting troops into Estonia, missiles into countries on the Russian border like Poland and Romania. Am I just imagining that the United States is encircling Russia militarily?
No, Alex, I don't think you are. And this has us really scared because it's so deep and structural and it's so pervasive, and it's very difficult to get any contrary narratives into the U.S. press. And in Washington, when you talk to some people, once I tried to talk to someone in the National Security Council about how foolish all of this was, and I got a tirades about evil Russia. And it's really, I think it's very scary, and you know, I can't say enough bad about it. It's completely unnecessary and counterproductive to U.S. security.
And what I don't get is, like, the Soviet Union gave up, and Russia attempted a form of capitalism, sort of, and why hasn't the United States given up the dream of war with Russia?
Well, it serves so many interests. I tried to make a little list of the reasons while we were waiting to come on the air, and you know, here's some of them. The military-industrial complex needs money. I think you alluded to that already. And not just money, but the U.S. deep state gains power in this way and consolidates and continues its power. I think we're seeing now also the use of hating or fearing Russia as a way of unifying the country politically and creating an opposition to the Trump administration, which I would say, you know, there's all kinds of reasons to be concerned about the Trump administration and to oppose it, but not Russia. So let's see, why Russia? Well, Russia is a big country. It's a nuclear peer or near peer. It could really destroy the United States completely with just a fraction of its nuclear arsenal. It has a tremendous resource base. It has a central location and highly advanced science, engineering, technology, and a unified, pretty unified politically. So there's a lot of reasons to be, if you wanted to pick a country to generate fear and hate toward, Russia would be ideal. There's also the deeper reasons. Its geographic location, its geopolitical importance. Much of the Cold War occurred because we didn't want Russia and Europe to be unified, especially Germany. So now we have really a decisive fraction of Europe's natural gas coming from Russia, and that will continue. There's a real struggle over the energy basis of Europe and how much of that Russia will control. Other than Qatari gas, there's no big alternative to Iranian and Russian gas in reverse order of importance. So it goes really all the way back to the 19th century and the early 20th century. We could mention the British geographer Halford Mackinder, who noted that, and I think his theory of what's called geographic pivot of history, that whoever controls Eastern Europe commands the heartland, as he called it, and whoever commands the heartland can control the world. And that is really the enduring thrust of U.S. policy toward Russia. It has been for decades, and it's basically an inherited strategy from the British Great Game. And it's, you know, written into official documents recently as 2015 in the National Military Strategy of the U.S. It was in the Bush-era documents. It was in 1992, Wolfowitz's draft guidance, what was it called, draft guidance for post-war, let's see the formal name of it here, it's slipping my mind. But the idea is that no peer competitor of the United States should be allowed to arise. And Russia is the, Russia and China are the two possible peer competitors. Oh yeah, that was Wolfowitz document was called the Draft Defense Planning Guidance. You can Google it online. It was leaked and it was, the quote here is from Wolfowitz, "Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival." Remember, this was right after the end of the Cold War. "This is a dominant consideration underlying the new regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power. These regions include Western Europe, East Asia, the territory of the former Soviet Union, and Southwest Asia. So Russia is the preeminent geographic concern of people who think this way, and which is pretty much, at this point, most of the empowered U.S. foreign policy establishment.
In a way, you've made me feel better and worse because, in a sense, it isn't that Donald Trump is the guy who's, well, he's going to push more spending on the U.S. atomic arsenal and more military spending, but that's just part of a long, long trend of strategy that you've just outlined. Trump's just the new guy who's getting tuned into the old story.
That sounds exactly right. And where he goes off message and tries to make peace with Russia, then he's attacked. As soon as he launches 59 cruise missiles and drops the mother of all bombs, then he is praised by the neoconservatives for acting presidentially.
It's amazing. That is how it works.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Greg Mello from the Los Alamos Study Group. Did you write that the recent increase in U.S. military spending is bigger than the entire Russian military budget?
I think I wrote that it's almost as big, and I'm not sure that I am a great enough expert on how these dollar figures translate over into Russia, but it's very close to the same amount. So it's shocking, really.
I want to float an idea by you, Greg. Just give me a second. At the Munich Security Conference in 2007, talking about the development of American nuclear superiority, possibly, Vladimir Putin said, quote, "We will respond accordingly, but how? We can match you in your actions and build an equally great multi-million-dollar anti-missile defense system, or, taking into account our economics and financial capability in the current day, we can respond asymmetrically," end quote. Now, I suggest that nuclear worry is one force driving the Russians to interfere in American elections. They've got to get people who aren't following that line of trying to take them over. And so this election idea is kind of an asymmetrical response that maybe a chess player like Putin would consider. What do you think?
Well, Alex, I don't think there's any proof that the Russians interfered with the election. I haven't read the book, but this new, just to pick the latest, one of the latest additions to this discussion, that book Shattered, which is about the Clinton campaign, has a passage that within 24 hours after the election, John Podesta and Robbie Mook decided that they were going to stress the Russian angle. And I think that that is all part of the demonization of Russia. But your original point about the asymmetric response is, quoting Putin, they have, in the 10 years since then, they have developed and I think now beginning to deploy maneuvering warheads, even missiles, which in their boost phase can change direction. And it's much cheaper for them to develop better missiles than to try to make an anti-ballistic missile system. Ours doesn't really work, probably never work, and it's a good way to transfer money to contractors. But to the extent that Russia, you know, Russia's a, oh, they have their fantasies about technology just like we do, to the extent that they believe it and their military-industrial complex seizes upon it, they will simply develop more powerful offensive weapons, probably for 10 or 20 cents on the dollar we spend on ineffective ABM systems.
Following some really outrageous claims by Alex Jones and by others, I'm asking this question of a couple of people. Do you believe there is any serious person in the Pentagon or the administration who would consider a first strike nuclear attack on Russia?
I do not believe that any person would do so. I think there are moral considerations, and not everyone would agree with me there, but not everyone is a complete sociopath. It takes coordination of a lot of people to do anything like that. And so there would be, I think that there'd be ethical people who would do the right thing and make it difficult to set that up. But apart from that, Russia has road mobile, rail mobile systems, and the submarines, while we may be able to find most of them before they could launch their missiles, although I don't know that, I think that would be the most optimistic case. The idea that one could sink every single Russian submarine with ballistic missiles as a prelude to a first strike by the U.S., I don't think that's possible. So if even 5% of the Russian nuclear force struck the U.S., it would completely obliterate the United States. So, you know, it's just not likely.
It's suicidal is what it is.
Yes. The threat of nuclear war is used, has lots of uses, and indeed it's very scary, I mean, for real reasons. Don't think that I'm not afraid of nuclear war by miscalculation or that some president or some successor to Putin in Russia could do terrible things. And plus Russia has got in addition to what I mentioned before, they have a so-called dead hand system they call perimeter that has multiple sensors. But if nuclear detonations start occurring on Russian soil, then rockets go up with the launch command. And it's a fairly automated system, not completely. But they put that there because of the possibility of a disarming first strike. And so it's, you know, it goes right back, not quite the doomsday machine of Dr. Strangelove, but it's very serious stuff. And I don't think that anybody would be crazy enough to do that. What people might be crazy enough to do is to think that they could launch a regional, like a tactical nuclear weapon in a regional war, or to protect a surrounded pocket of U.S. soldiers, or in retaliation for China sinking or even North Korea sinking aircraft carrier or something like that. There might be popular pressure, that sort of thing. And then that could, it'd be bad enough in itself, but it could also spiral out of hand quickly.
You know, for difficult things, Greg, humans tend to rely on their only experience, whatever it is. And for nuclear bombs, that means Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Both those cities rebuilt. They're quite vibrant today. Why is it different now?
That's a terrific question. Those were small nuclear bombs, and their effects were relatively localized, both in terms of the thermal effects, the blast effects, the fallout, and the what the British would say, the knock-on effects across society. I personally believe that one thermonuclear bomb would be enough to knock out the United States as a united, functioning society. Modern society is a lot more fragile than people think. That's the other change. The skills, the just-in-time delivery of goods, supply chains, manufacturing, the nodes of energy, both fossil fuel and electrical, all these are very delicate. But going back to the direct effects, a large thermonuclear weapon will burn down a large city and create a hellstorm of fire, and no one can survive. It's like Dresden times 1,000. And then there's the fallout. So if, say, a ground bursts over there, even at the ICBM fields in Wyoming or wherever, those threaten fatal fallout in the U.S. Midwest, you know, hundreds of miles away. So it's quite different.
It's so hard to imagine a full nuclear war, and we can't. I mean, in my mind, the only comparison is the asteroid that hit the Earth about 65 million years ago. Scientists believe the sun was blotted out by the dust. Most species shivered and died. That's not too drastic for a nuclear exchange between America and Russia. And I think it's important to say, too, that the forecast of nuclear winter after the use of nuclear weapons, it's not just an idea made up by peaceniks or environmentalists. It's based on real science from physicists, people who know the field. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. I'm really glad you brought that up. I'm sorry I forgot to say it. Yeah, that's, you know, everything burns. When everything burns, like I'm looking out at an asphalt street right now, that would burn. And millions of tons of black soot would be carried up by the winds of these storms. So, you know, a big thermonuclear bomb creates a giant hot bubble in the atmosphere, like maybe a mile across. And that thing rises up at, say, 300 miles an hour, sucks everything up. It goes right up through the top of the troposphere, and that firestorm that follows also goes right on through, and that black soot would hang out above all the weather where the sun in the daytime would hit those black particles and re-loft them. So whatever natural settling takes place would be counteracted by the permanent sunshine up there. And so they stay up there for a really long time and blocking the sun and preventing food crops, making it really cold for a really long time, and it would be extremely hard for most life to exist. And the only question in this whole analysis is, where are the nuclear bombs targeted to create the initial cloud of soot? I mean, if they are in flat, farmland, there's not that much to burn. But if they are in cities, then there is a lot to burn.
And I'm wondering, if the worst happened and there was a nuclear war between the United States and Russia, would my listeners in New Zealand and Australia survive all right?
Well, you can go to nucleardarkness.org, a great website produced by Steve Starr, and read about these effects in detail. And he's got some animated pictures there of different nuclear war scenarios. It takes a while, but the low temperatures go down into the southern hemisphere as well. There's mixing in the atmosphere, as you would expect. And it doesn't take a lot to curtail the growing season. So, you know, if you're in New Zealand and you experience, say, a 3 or 5 degree centigrade temperature drop, you can't really grow anything. And you can't be resupplied from anywhere in these scenarios because there's no resupply. So it's universal.
I want to go back to one thing that you touched on, and that is the president's ability to order a nuclear strike. And, you know, my fear, and I think it's shared by a lot of other people, is could the Donald do it one grumpy night at 3 a.m. at the time he's tweeting, unopposed and unchecked? But I'm hopeful that, as you said, there's some sort of machinery where they could say, well, Mr. President, our equipment isn't ready or something, to stop that from happening.
Yes. That speculation on my part is a kind of a judgment. I think the right answer for me is I just don't know. I'm skeptical of the claims. We've heard talks by U.S. senior officials that, you know, this is how it works. Well, then you ask a few questions, and I'm not sure it is so simple that it works the way that they say. But on the other hand, I don't know how it works. So, and I think we'll never know how it works.
They don't want you to know how it works.
Right.
Okay. Now, it sounds to me like the nuclear weapons game is almost like a kind of gangsterism that we perform on ourselves. The whole world is held hostage to it. Is there any way out?
Yes. The first things that we need to do is start talking. And, you know, you'll see a pattern in the press coverage here in this Russiagate scandal or drama, soap opera, whatever you want to call it, where, you know, Michael Flynn talked to the Russian ambassador. Oh, my God, they're talking. Well, what, you know, that's what ambassadors are for. That incoming administration needs to talk to people. Okay, so we talk. We need to talk. And that can be done through many channels in many ways, and it ought to happen. We need to be standing down some of our forces that I think anything that creates greater confidence. Right now, there's a ready to start again at the UN. There are negotiations to ban nuclear weapons. Now, those are opposed by both the U.S. and Russia. And we ought to just let those proceed and take the fallout, which will, you know, the nuclear establishment is where the fallout is going to come to. We can stop modernizing excessively, start cutting back. And if we've got channels open, the Russians may do the same. And right now, the U.S. and Russia have 93% of the world's intact nuclear weapons. So really, this is still, and if you include NATO countries, that makes 96%. So the nuclear weapons problem is not exclusively a NATO versus Russia problem, but it is importantly a NATO versus U.S. problem. we can move our, you brought up the forward positioning of troops and their armored divisions. And in fact, NATO made sure that they were Germans. So we put German armored divisions on Russia's border, which never happened since World War II. And it's all done quite consciously. You know, there was a congressional staff member, a neocon. I heard about this from another staff member. He spoke at a conference in Paris. He said, let's move nuclear weapons to border Russia, and because that would really tick them off. And so that is an attitude which is in the U.S. government and in key places. And we need to establish the opposite attitude. Why would it be in our interest to tick off the Russians? Well, because as you said in the beginning, we want to dismantle the Russian state. We want to weaken or dismantle it because of these long-term considerations. And even Henry Kissinger has said that the policy of the Obama administration is one of breaking Russia. Well, that's just the wrong attitude. It'll never work. And if we dismantle that attitude and realize that the other guy's security is also our security, then we can get that vector going in the good direction. Then we can refocus some of our efforts in building the country that is kind of run down and taking care of our terrible climate problem.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation, and I'm sorry to say we are running out of time. How do people find the Los Alamos Study Group?
We're on the web at lasg.org for Los Alamos Study Group.
I urge people to check it out. Greg Mello, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Greg Mello is the executive director of the nonprofit group, Los Alamos Study Group. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.